Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lisa's Book Divas, where you'll get a sneak peek into the lives behind the authors, celebrities, and entertainers that you love to read about. Sit back, relax, and let Lisa and her guests entertain you. And now, your Book Divas host, Lisa LC.
Good afternoon, Book Divas fans. Today, we have a New York Times bestselling author with us, one you probably will recognize the name to, Janice Y.K. Lee, and she's going to talk about her new paperback release of The Expatriates, which she actually just came out mid-October 11th, I believe, Penguin Books. If you want to check that out, you can go to janiceyklee.com or the bookdivas.com website. And I want to thank you for being on the show with us today, Janice. And how are you doing today? I know you've got a little bit of a cold, so I guess I'm giving that a heads up to anybody. So bless you ahead of time and all that good stuff. But hopefully we'll get through the half hour here without too many problems there. But thanks for coming on. We appreciate you and having you here with us. And we want to talk about your fantastic book and your new releases out in this past month here. Janice, are you able to hear us online here?
Oh, yes, I can hear you now.
There we go. Okay. Sorry about that. We had a little bit of a technical issue there. Okay. Janice, we're on the air, and we're excited to talk to you about your new book, The Expatriates, and find out a little bit more about your writing process. And I know you're going to be reading an excerpt later on, and just wanted to welcome you and just say this is an awesome book. So if you haven't checked this out, go to the website, janiceykaylee.com, or pick it up at your favorite online retailer or bookstore.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
So, Janice, when you wrote this story, did you write this from personal experience, obviously, being a transplant, or an expat?
An expat.
Is that the right
terminology? Expatriate, yes. It's an expat. So I did write it. It's funny because my first book was also set in Hong Kong, but it was a historical novel, so I did a lot of research. And during that time, in the writing of the first book, I ended up moving to Hong Kong as an expat. But as I always like to explain to people, I am originally from Hong Kong. I was born and raised there, although I'm Korean and not Chinese. So a lot of people would say that I'm not a local. So I was always sort of other. I was a Korean living in Hong Kong, which was a British colony at the time. And then I ended up moving to the U.S. for school and getting married and having children here. And then while I was working on my book, I moved back to Hong Kong as an expat. And after I finished my first novel, The Piano Teacher, I started working on this book. And it was really set in the world that I found myself living in, which is the world of the American expatriate, also the world of a woman who has followed her husband for a job that he has overseas. And that's a very singular experience.
And would you recommend that experience to other women that have read the book? Or what's the best thing that came out of that experience?
Oh, absolutely.
Besides
I think
the book, of course.
Everyone, yes, everyone should travel and live in places other than, you know, if you have the opportunity, I think you'd be foolish not to take it. There's so much of the world to see, and I think Americans don't travel enough. And if you have the opportunity to take a job elsewhere and it seems like a good opportunity, I think you would, everyone in your family would benefit from taking that. But what I did find was that people went with the best of intentions, and then also you're sort of immersed in the business of your family, and life is very busy. So when these people came to a different country or a different city, they actually ended up surrounding themselves by people who were a lot like them. And it became a sort of bubble existence, almost inadvertently, and that's the book that the world that I try to portray in The Expatriates, the bubble of American expats living in a foreign country. And I've heard from a lot of expatriates in different parts of the world that actually the experience of being an expatriate seems quite similar. There are universal themes about moving away from your home to a different place, how you find comfort, how you explore or don't. So these were all things that I was sort of working through when I was working on the book.
Very interesting. And it's a fantastic book. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Janice White. Well, Janice Lee. Do you want me to address you as Janice White Lee or just Janice Lee?
You can just call me Janice.
I'll just use Janice. That's easier.
Yes.
And you're a former editor of, was it Ellie and...
I worked at Elle Magazine and Mirabelle Magazine when I graduated from college, and I moved down to New York, and I was trying to figure out a way where I, you know, since I was a young child, I always wanted to read and write, and that's all I ever wanted to do, and I was trying to figure out how to make your life about that. And in college, I studied English literature, and I knew I wanted to write fiction. And it seemed like the way that other writers were doing that was by working either, you know, they were teaching or they were working at publications, a lot of people going into journalism. So I ended up finding a job at a monthly magazine. And then I ended up in the features section and also in the books section, which was wonderful because I got free books and I was able to read them and talk about them. It was the best job in the world.
And then you became the writer. And now there's no turning back, right?
No, it's, well, sometimes I miss the office life, to tell you the truth. I miss
do
the
you?
Structure, but no, it's, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I think the grass is always greener. I love working from home and I love writing, but I do sometimes miss sort of the camaraderie. It can get quite lonely.
Yeah. That's probably where Mercy came from, right?
Yeah, no. A little bit. 20-something.
You've got to be a little bit of each of your characters in this story, are you not?
I don't know. I always think that my characters are entirely imagined. And, of course, I ascribe mm-hmm. characters to their, you know, personality things and quirks that I see in other people or in myself, but I do think they're not. You know, Mercy is a Korean-American who is a 20-something who moves to Hong Kong and nothing ever goes right for her. So, you know, there are definitely, as a Korean-American myself, there are definitely things in her life that I ascribe that I'm very familiar with, and so I was able to paint her in a way I think that is pretty accurate. And I suppose there are parts of every character that are part of me. For example, Margaret is a mother of three, and I have four children, and I actually wrote a lot about being a mother because that was such a transformative and intense experience for me, and I'm sure everyone else.
It's you know, when you open the book and you pick this up, opening it up, and I got pulled right into Mercy right away. My heart went out to her, and I could relate to her, and I chuckled through the fortune teller. You know.
Right.
And I don't know, how is fortune telling looked at in Hong Kong? Is that a taboo thing, or is that welcome?
No, it's not taboo. I mean, I think there's some tension with sort of Christianity and organized religion, but I would say that fortune telling is from Mercy's side, it's more of the Korean background, and I think it's had a history in both in Asia for a lot of different cultures. But my parents always used to say to me, "Oh, I can tell what kind of life that person has had because you can see it in his face." And I used to wonder what they were talking about. And now that I'm older, I think it's true, and I think it's true of all cultures. When I look at someone, I sort of can tell a lot about them and the life they've lived from their face.
Yeah, I don't know.
Which
why
is
a
useful thing.
Yeah. Or comes with age, comes with drinking lots of tea, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, there's a scene in there, and I don't know, I'll let you share it, where Mercy finds her fortune, I guess you'd say. But it's not really
right.
In a language she can read, so she
right. She goes out to the street to find someone to translate it for her. But I remember, you know, I would always hear from when I was a young child, and I was in a place with a lot of older Korean women. They'd always talk about people's faces, and you know, it wasn't whether they were pretty or handsome. It was more that person has a sharp chin, or that person's you know, face is so dark, it, you know, there's so much worry there, or the forehead is too large. So, you know, and they all meant something, and I never knew exactly what they were talking about, but I sort of inferred a lot as I grew older. And you know, some people have comfortable faces, some people have a lot of tension in their face, and that was something that I thought was so interesting.
You know, I don't go through life looking at people that way. And you reading that and hearing you say this, reading your book and hearing you say this makes me go, maybe I should spend more time studying a phoenix. And I don't want to be a fortune teller, but you know, there's some truth to it. You know, when you bring that up that way, you really can see the worry or the tension in people's faces, and so I think that's a very cool insight. I don't know how you research. How did you research? Did you actually go and research that? Did you go interview people, or how did you?
That in particular, I did not. I just drew from my own life and the few experiences that I've had of it. It was just, you know, when someone said, "Oh, that woman has such a comfortable face," and I would look at that person, I'd think, "Oh, she is very comfortable. She feels like she's content and happy." So these are just things that I didn't have to research it. It was more just living my life. It was quite a difference from my first book, which did require a lot of research because I studied it in World War II Hong Kong, and I had to read a lot of books, a lot of history books and memoirs and newspapers, and for that sort of research, you know, it's not the facts. The facts are one thing, the details of events and when they happened, especially in a wartime novel, but it was also what people wore or, you know, how much things cost, because I think it's so fascinating to see how much things cost back then, how much was a fancy dinner, how much was a plane ticket. If you went on the plane, was it only for the rich at that time, or what would you wear if you went on a plane, because I know that people used to dress up a lot more than they did. So that was the kind of thing that I found fascinating when I was writing a historical novel. The Expatriates was set in the world I lived in, so I didn't have to do any research at all other than live my life.
Mm-hmm. What's your writing process? So you get up in the morning, and do you get to block off? I mean, you've got four children, correct? Am I
right,
that?
Yeah.
Two twins, or
yeah, I have twins. The third and fourth were twins, so that was, you know, good and very busy for a long time.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
But when you're writing, I mean, are you more of a morning writer or an all day writer, or just whenever you can get a break? With four kids, that's a lot. I mean, so you.
There are long swathes of time where I do not write at all, and I think I'm more of a, when I achieve critical mass and my project is really cooking, that's when I work. Mm-hmm. And so I can't characterize any given day or week in for my schedule and say I work from 10 to 2 or I really don't work when I don't have anything, and when I have something I work all the time, and you know, even if my kids are home, I am working in my office. So there comes a time with each book where I was really working a lot because it was really, there was enough there that, and I knew where it was going. Right now I'm you know, starting a third book, and it's more of a short story, and I don't know where it's going yet, so I'm not actually spending a lot of time on it. I think I'm more working on it in my head. But when all that stuff's coalesced and I know what the book is and where it's going, then I just work as much as I can. And I try to arrange my life so that is possible.
Do you use any, for other writers that might be looking to you for advice, do you use a writing software, or are you more pen and paper?
Oh, I'm very, I use a computer, but I'm a Luddite in terms of software, so I use Microsoft Word, but I use it, I don't use any of those edit functions, I just write, and then I print it out, and then I edit on the page, because I can't edit on the screen to save my life. I need it on paper, and I need a pen, and I need to cross out things and write down the revisions, and then I input them into the document, and then I just save it again. So I think that's actually a very basic way of using Microsoft Word, which I know has gotten very technical and, you know, can do many miraculous things, none of which I know how to do. So I basically use the computer as much as, it's sort of like a glorified typewriter.
Sure. You know, in fact, I just picked up an app the other day because I'm one of these people who, well, I thought I would be able to write on an iPad. Sorry, iPad.
Oh, gosh, I can't imagine.
I struggle. I hit that little emoji button more times. I ended up
right-handed
because I keep hitting that other screen. But I bought this program because it was actually specifically a typewriter program. So you're like typing, it looks like you're hitting typewriter keys. And I thought, well, this will be fun. I played around with it a little bit. It was kind of fun. But I'm a little bit like old school, maybe. I don't want to sound like you, but I mean, I do use some different softwares. But very sparingly. I mean, I'm just as happy using a text program or just something. But I've learned as more when I'm working, I like to work. I don't do too much outlining, but I'm more of a thinker in my head. Of, like I'll think all day what I'm going to write, and at night or whatever time I'm going to sit down, it comes out quite quickly. I mean, I can pop out 2,000 words in 45 minutes quite quickly.
That's
but
amazing.
Well, it's just because I've thought about it all day. So
right.
I'm doing NaNoWriMo
right
now.
Right. I think that's how a lot of writing happens. It happens in your head for a long time, and you're always thinking about the book that you're working on or whatever you're working on. And then when you're ready to write, that has been my experience as well, that I'm working a lot in my head before I'm ready to put anything to paper.
Yeah, and that's a good way to do that. And I don't know, there are so many things, and you can drown yourself in softwares and programs and how-tos and everything. And the best teacher is really reading, I think, a lot
that's
of books.
That's right.
Not just how-to books. I mean, I read a lot of anything
you
can pick up. But read books. Read your genre. Read how other writers. And follow the trends, because they go up and down and back and forth. And
that's exactly right. Like when people ask me, well, how do I write? How do I begin a life as a writer? And I just say, read.
Mm-hmm.
You have to read so much before you can even start to write anything good. You have to know what is good writing, what is writing that you like but is not good, or what is writing that you don't like but is good. You have to know all. You have to be an expert in reading before you can become a writer of any sort.
No, I agree with that. And when you take us to the day you got your first book contract, you know, had you been submitting The Piano Teacher around a long time? Was it rejected a lot?
You know, I was very lucky. I had been, in my 20s, I had been writing short stories and sending them out and not having much luck. I got a few published here and there, but it was really hard work. I ended up quitting my job and going to get an MFA at Hunter College under the wonderful Chang Rae Lee. And he actually introduced me to my agent. He said, I think you'll just like her. Why don't you go for lunch? And we went for lunch, and she took me on the basis of a few short stories, which was wonderful of her. But I didn't have anything. And so basically our relationship was such that she would take me out to lunch once a year and ask me how I was doing. And I'd tell her, you know, I'm working on this. And then I started working on The Piano Teacher, and I said, I think this is, you know, something that I might make a novel out of, because I'd never written a novel. I'd only been writing short stories. And she sort of encouraged me. And it took a long time. It took around 5 years from start to finish. And so how it happened with The Piano Teacher was very quick and wonderful, but it doesn't sort of take into account all the years of writing that I had before and all the short stories that had gotten rejected. But with the Piano Teacher, I finished it. And the way I write, I don't do many drafts. I just revise assiduously along the way, so by the time I get to the end, it's pretty clean. And I had sent it to her. I finally sent her the final manuscript, and she was headed to Frankfurt, the international rights conference that all the publishers go to. And she said, "I think I can sell this." And I couldn't believe that something that had existed just in my own mind and in my own dreams had become something that she thought she could sell. And she did sell it. She sold it 12 hours later to a Spanish publisher of all people, and then you know, we sold it to a bunch of foreign publishers, and then a week later she came back and there was an auction for it in the U.S. So it was this sort of amazing thing that happened that I couldn't believe. But it had been you know, decades in the making, decades of me reading and writing and being rejected and trying to figure out, you know, what I was going to work on that was a longer project. But when I finished it, it did happen very quickly, for which I am eternally grateful, because I know that it's very difficult to publish a book these days.
It is. And, you know, I don't know if you've explored the self-publishing route, or if you will, and, you know, someday if you get your, you know, if you get your rights back or choose to whatever contracts you're in. And who knows? Who knows 5 years from now how that's going to change? And, you know, like now everybody's doing their own audiobooks, which I think is fascinating. I think it's great. And if people have the skill to even record their own audiobook, that's even
more. It is a whole new world. I mean, we don't know how people are reading.
But I won't give up my paper copies. I just can't. You know,
they are very wonderful.
I need books. I need physical copies. And I don't even know what a room, my office would look like without books. If it was, I don't know what I would put on my shelves. I don't know.
I'm always suspicious of people without books in their house.
Yeah, there you go. Well, take us into a little bit about the three characters that we're going to meet in your story, and then you're going to read an excerpt for us, I believe. And so I don't know if you want to read that first, and then take us a little bit into who we'll meet in the story.
I'll explain a little bit of the book, which is, so it's about three American women who end up in finding themselves as expats in Hong Kong, and they're all expats of different sorts. So Mercy is a young expat. She is a young, unmarried, single, 20-something who has not had luck finding a career in New York, and so she decides to try to Hong Kong. And she goes there, and she has trouble finding work as well. And she ends up working as a part-time babysitter for another woman, Margaret, who is there as a wife to an executive who has moved to Hong Kong for his work, and she has three children. And then the third woman is Hillary, and she has been in Hong Kong as a wife of an expat as well. And they've been trying to have children, but they haven't been successful. So, and their lives are connected by a central tragic event, which I won't give away right now. But you don't know what it is for a little bit, and then you figure out how they're all connected and how this has all changed them. And the excerpt I read is a little from the perspective of Hillary, who's the woman who's been in Hong Kong for a while but does not have children, and how there are seasons of expatriates and how being an expat is often a lot like college because everyone knows that you're there for a limited amount of time, and then you're there in this very bonded and intense way, but then people leave. So I'll read from that. Hillary, how is it already May? May and June are going away party season and pack up for the summer season. The expatriates have renewed or not renewed their contracts. They have quit or found something back home. The factory has closed or HQ has downsized the office. Elderly parents are ailing and they are needed. Some have just become fed up with life in Hong Kong and decided to pack it up and leave. There are homesick wives who tell their husbands they've had it with the air pollution and the unsafe food standards and take off with the kids, leaving their spouses to work and send money home. This sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. The wife comes back to Hong Kong, or there is a divorce, or the man returns home and finds another job. If the expats are staying for another year or two, the moms take the kids and go on home leave, staying at their parents' or in-laws' houses, camping out at others' homes through the summer. So in May or June, when the kids are finishing up with school, the packers are called, tram parties are booked, and many, many boozy lunches and dinners are had at the American Club or the China Club or some fancy Italian restaurant in Central. Hillary sits at the kitchen table with her laptop, sipping coffee and going through her emails, finding out who is leaving. It's a bit like the end of college, when you bid farewell to the friends you've made before going on to the next stage of life. You might see them again, but never in the same normal, everyday kind of way. Hillary has gone to so many of these lunches, she knows the format like the back of her hand. First, a bottle of champagne and a toast to the departing friend. Then the presentation of a group gift arranged by many, many emails sent around beforehand. A gift statistically most likely to be from Shanghai Tang, a frame or perhaps a wine stopper, but not before a card is surreptitiously handed around so everyone can sign. There will also most probably be a photo album, compiled of many pictures of group outings to Shenzhen to buy fake DVDs and have clothes tailored, dinners at the China Club, girls' night out at Flo, family days on the American Club lawn, joint vacations to Bali beaches. It's akin to a college yearbook, she supposes, a way to mark several years in one's life, when one has inevitably changed and grown in ways that are hard to see, until you find yourself back in the United States, trying to explain to people what life was like in Asia, and finding out that they care not one whit. But you will have this album to flip through, and a wine stopper, and that memory of the people who were there with you. That's the shock and the surprise to a lot of repatriates. No one back home cares. There's an initial shallow interest in what life is like abroad, but most Americans aren't actually interested at all. They're back to talking about their divorces going on at work, or how the neighborhood pharmacy is going under, or how highway construction has added 40 minutes to their commute. They don't want to know about the trip to Hoi An and how Vietnam has changed immensely, or how Beijing's pollution is so thick that when you were there, you had to wear a handkerchief over your face. America is so vast, and there's so much to see just in the 50 states, these people tell you. It's like you never have to leave. This insularity will seem shocking for the first year back, when reentry is difficult, when you miss the ease of Hong Kong, forgetting all your complaints from when you were there, remembering only the good winter weather, the amazing dumplings, and cheap taxis. But all too soon, most everyone slips into the warm comforts of America, so convenient, so uniform, forgetting there's anything outside its borders. There's a moment in all these farewell parties when the person leaving is alone, drying her hands in the bathroom, waiting at the bar for a drink, and she foresees a moment in her new old life. Perhaps it will be the still, frozen Thursday night light of a mall, refracting through the window of a TGI Fridays, as she were surrounded by old high school friends in this most American of venues, chosen out of what they choose to call nostalgia, but is usually something deeper and more fraught. The uneasy push-pull of the giant frozen cocktail, the greasy blooming onion, the all-encompassing and smothering embrace of America. Or she'll see another moment in her imminent future when she's looking back into the past, washing dishes in the waning light of a Columbus, Ohio kitchen, sudsy hands gripping greasy dishes. A woman will summon up a startling picture of herself, a moment in Hong Kong when she was walking across the lobby of the Mandarin Hotel in a fitted sheath and expensive stiletto-heeled shoes, the kind she has no use for anymore, on her way to meet a friend for lunch or walking through the streets with her toddler on her hip, while her helper, her servant, trailed behind, carrying the diaper bag and various other accoutrements of daily life she hadn't had to bother herself with. What a life it was. What a life they had all had. While many of them had complained the whole time they were stationed in Hong Kong, it is only after they leave, when they are ensconced in their old lives with no change visible ahead, for decades ahead, that they will appreciate the wonder of what they had experienced. At the farewell parties and back at home, they will take a moment to see themselves with their present friends, their old friends, their new old friends, the past meeting the present, endlessly echoing back and forth, and they'll see their future so close, bumping into the moment and frighteningly the same, and they'll wonder if their past, their time away in the Far East, was just that, a dream. That is Hillary.
That is Hillary. You know, there's so much I want to cover, and unfortunately there just won't be the time. But real quickly, how the cultural differences, I mean, you're going to find cultural differences in these books, in this book, and what is it like for a woman not to be able to have, I mean, are they judged harshly for not having children more than having children that are, children that might act out of line?
I don't think they're judged. I think they are excluded. So I think that there's a, you know, I would say that most women who have gone to Hong Kong as a trailing spouse of an expat and who are expats themselves, I would say the majority of them do have children. So there's a whole life revolving around children. And if you don't have children, you're just not part of that as much. It's much more difficult. You know, your kids aren't friends, or you just don't have that extra thing. So I think that people feel lonely. And so I would imagine that if you were in that situation, you would work. But it's hard to work because sometimes you're not allowed to work because you don't have the right, you know, visa. Mm-hmm. Or so I don't think it was exclusion. I don't think it was judgment, but more sort of a more passive exclusion that would be difficult.
Sure. Well, it looks like we're out of time already. Janice,
oh, wow.
Give us your website again real quick for people that are just tuning in or have been listening and want to check out your books.
It's www.janiceykaylee.com, and I also have a Facebook page under Janice YK Lee.
And so check that out. You've got a couple interviews, at least one interview on there. The piano teacher watched that. It's a very, very good interview, by the way.
Thank you.
And Jenith, I want to thank you for being our featured guest today. And any time, you know, I'm going to keep your book handy on my shelf, and any time I want to go back to the start, your expatriate story, and meet your characters again, or just remember, you know, how lives can be predictable, maybe, but how it's the human connection, really, that determines
right.
its outcome, I think. Yeah,
that's right.
So thank you. Thank you so very much for being our guest today. We look forward to having you back on, I hope, in the near future and with your next book. And can you give us a hint of what we're looking for the next time?
I think it's about three couples who have moved out to the suburbs. That's all I know right now. So,
okay.
But thank you so
that's
much. It was
start.
A pleasure to be on your show, Lisa.
Thank you so much. We'll keep my eyes on you. We'll hook up with you again on your next book when that comes out.
Sounds good.
Thanks. All right, thank you.
All right, thank
you. Yeah, thank you, Janice. If you're just tuning in or you'd like to get a copy of the interview, you can check that out at blogtalkradio.com/bookdivas, or you can pick up the archive at our website if you just go to bookdivas.com and click on the live link show. That'll take you right to the archives. So this is Lisa, and I'm signing out until our next broadcast next week. We've got actually three interviews that we'll be doing, Hunter Jones and Kevin Chambers and Lisa Poloni for her Joan. And, well, I guess I'll have to have you go back to the website on that one. I'm going to have you check those out right on the site, bookdivas.com. We've been talking, like I said, with Janice Wakeley, and we look forward to having you back. This is Lisa signing out to our next broadcast.